Freedom News Hour with Walt Thiessen, Jake Towne, and Melinda Pillsbury Foster, Thursdays at 6 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know.
It's the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, along with my co-host, Jake Towne. Melinda Pillsbury Foster is on a break this week. She'll be joining us again next week. But Jake and I have a pretty interesting story set up for you today. A lot of things going on in the headlines. More bad news, of course, coming regarding foreclosure numbers, as well as some very bad unemployment numbers continuing their ongoing saga. But at the top of our list, we have a report from the Congressional Oversight Panel reporting today that international banks benefited heavily from the $700 billion TARP bailout in 2008, while similar interventions by foreign countries' banks did not benefit the U.S. much at all. The panel is calling for countries to share the pain in the event of future bailouts. From the report, they said, faced with the possible collapse of their most important financial institutions, many national governments intervened. One of the main components of the U.S. response was, of course, the $700 billion TARP, which pumped capital into financial institutions and guaranteed billions of dollars in debt and troubled assets and directly purchased assets. The U.S. Treasury and Federal Reserve offered further support by allowing banks to borrow cheaply from the government by guaranteeing selected pools of assets. Other nations' interventions used the same basic set of policy tools, but with a key difference. While the United States attempted to stabilize the system by flooding money into as many banks as possible, including those that had significant overseas operations, most other nations targeted their efforts more narrowly toward institutions that in many cases had no major U.S. operations. And as a result, it appears likely that America's financial rescue had a much greater impact internationally than other nations' programs had on the United States. This outcome was likely inevitable given the structure of the TARP, the report says, but if the U.S. government had gathered more information about which countries' institutions would most benefit from some of its actions, it might have been able to ask those countries to share the pain of rescue. For example, banks in France and Germany were among the greatest beneficiaries of the AIG rescue, yet the U.S. government bore the entire $70 billion risk of the AIG capital injection program. The U.S. share of this single rescue exceeded the size of France's entire $35 billion capital injection program and was nearly half the size of Germany's entire $133 billion program. Now, the report also goes on to say financial crises have occurred many times in the past and will undoubtedly occur again in the future. Failure to plan ahead will only undermine efforts to safeguard the financial system. Careful policymakers would put plans in place before the next crisis rather than responding on an ad hoc basis at the peak of the storm, unquote. Now, this report is very interesting, of course, for three reasons. First, and most importantly, it contradicts President Obama's lie in July when he claimed that the Dodd-Frank Act would ensure that never again would the American taxpayer be asked to bail out a big bank. Second, it makes a mockery of the Senate House Conference deliberations on the Dodd-Frank bill, where the legislators concluded that there was no point in trying to finance a future meltdown of the financial system until it actually happens. And finally, it demonstrates the global nature of the crisis in a way that few other official reports have done. So perhaps a little bit of truth coming out of Washington, Jake, amidst all the lies, a little bit of revelation amidst all of the smoke and mirrors. What do you think?
Well, it's a good point that you raise. I think that, a lot of the bailout has had international effects, and a lot of the, for instance, in the case of AIG, what they actually did bail out is still pretty much blacked out to the public, and a lot of that had to do with derivatives contracts that were, between the banks and, somewhere here, somewhere abroad. And again, the U.S. taxpayer was paid, put in the pretty weird position of bailing out a lot of the rest of the world, which in some cases is not too surprising, since when we look at our armed forces abroad, we're also paying for the patrolling of the German border, the Italian border, and a lot of other things also abroad.
Absolutely true. And of course, the ramifications continue here at home. As reports came out regarding both the unemployment picture and the foreclosure picture in particular continuing to be very, very dark. Lenders, according to an Associated Press report that came out today, repossessed 92,858 properties just last month. That's up 9% from June and an increase of 6% from July of last year, when foreclosures, of course, were hitting record numbers. This from the Realty Track Incorporated. Banks have also stepped up repossessions this year to clear out the backlog of bad loans. July makes the eighth month in a row that the pace of homes lost to foreclosure has increased on an annualized basis. Still, the number of homeowners who have fallen behind on their payments remains high, and these borrowers are being allowed to stay in their homes longer. That's partly because lenders are reluctant to add to the glut of foreclosed homes on the market, the report says. Of course, it doesn't point out the fact that every time that they have to take back a home, they also have to show it as a loss in their books. But we'll skip over that part, of course. Number of properties receiving an initial default notice, the first step in the foreclosure process, rose 1%. Which was down 28% versus July last year, according to Realty Track. The one thing that's particularly interesting among all the figures that come out of this AP article is that in all 325,229 properties received a foreclosure-related warning in July. That's up 4%, and it translates to more than one in 400 U.S. homes. So one out of 400 U.S. homes got a foreclosure notice just last month. Jake, the numbers just continue to get worse and worse.
Well, then combined with the fact that new housing starts, so new residential or apartment buildings are at an all-time, a 50-year low, which is pretty much since they began keeping tabs on it, even though the population has, increased quite a bit since the 1960s. And it'll be interesting to see how these things play out because, as you're aware, Walt, and our listeners may also be aware, what the government does is they prop up the housing market, and the Federal Reserve, the nation's central bank, has done this by purchasing bad assets that they know are worth less than that and keeping it on their balance books as, whatever the original value was. And the banks are doing the exact same thing. It's a whole bunch of accounting foolery at the end of the day. But what it is, if you let these imbalances get fixed, we would have, a recovery. But while the government just keeps postponing this bubble popping, time will tell what the final result is, but it's probably not going to be anything good.
And, of course, the reason they keep postponing and trying to put it off is they know that the moment they do pop the bubble, there is instant pain to be felt, and that's what they're trying to avoid. And as you point out, the longer they wait, the worse the pain gets. Well, I guess they never really learn, do they? Or perhaps it's us that never really learn. I'm not really quite sure which.
Well, how about the unemployment numbers? I think they were posted last Friday.
Yeah, they're pretty much holding the same. We're getting close to the high that was reached in January of 490,000, but they've been pretty much in the same range all along, currently seasonally adjusted at 484,000, according to the Labor Department on Thursday. So no relief in sight where that's concerned. And we always have to keep in mind, of course, that the numbers that are posted by the government do not reflect true unemployment. If you ever want to find out what true unemployment numbers, go to shadowstats.com. They do a great job of tracking that kind of information. If you take into account all aspects of people who are either underemployed or unemployed or simply haven't done any reporting to the government because they just ran out of benefits so long ago, you find that the true unemployment rate is probably close to 22%. Again, an underreported story that the media have continued to ignore as the months have trod on during this financial crisis.
Well, absolutely. And, the idea of having a jobless recovery, which you see about in the newspapers, is pretty much impossible. And I think that, for listeners, what's also important to realize is that, the job, a lot of the interventions that the government does in the labor market, in the tax market, and in the regulatory market actually prohibit and discourage employment. And all you really need to do is go through all these laws that they've created and ask yourself a simple question. Does this encourage or discourage employment? And if it discourages unemployment, what we just need to do as a people is, consider removing these exact laws.
Yeah, absolutely true. And one hopes that as the crisis continues to grow, more and more people will recognize that that's the kind of change that does have to take place. We can at least remain hopeful about that. The one thing, of course, that should be on everybody's mind but isn't is the fact that debt continues to drive the whole thing. We do have a debt-based monetary system, and under such a system, it can only get worse because the debt levels have to keep growing and growing in order for them to continue their pseudo-prosperity, which they like to foist upon us. And that's one of those things that just is eventually going to turn into a massive time bomb that's going to really wreak havoc in this country.
the bubbles that you were referring to earlier, Jake, popping them would certainly help. But in the long run, I mean, do you really see any way for us to avoid the coming catastrophe?
Well, you know, that's the question that's on everybody's minds. And I think that at the end of the day, the piper will be paid. It is kind of a matter of who ends up taking most of the hits. And if we study past history, what you're finding is, you know, the big banks will get the bailouts because they're in control of a lot of what goes on in our country, and the people will be left out to door. And that's happened. It happened in Russia after the communist regime collapsed. It happened in Argentina several years ago, and I think that unfortunately, that's what people need to realize and be educated on, is that most of the time it's the common folk that are there. That receive all the pain for this economic catastrophes that are brought on by the government and these banks.
That's absolutely true. And we should also point out that it's important to know that there are things you can do to at least try to alleviate the pain by taking actions in advance. There's no way we can eliminate the pain across the board, but each individual can take actions to at least try to protect their own family. First thing that you can do, and Americans are already starting to do this, is try to pay down whatever debt you already have if you're carrying debt. If you have money that you want to protect, you know, nest eggs and so forth that you want to protect, consider investing in precious metals because they tend to weather such storms very well. Unfortunately, the number of options available are fairly limited, but at least we can be cognizant of what can be done. Well, we're going to go to a break pretty quick here, and after the break, we're going to have a visit from Jason Ditz of Antiwar.com, who's going to discuss with us the role that WikiLeaks has played in exposing what's really going on in Afghanistan and in other parts of the world. They're going to, of course, present the Antiwar.com viewpoint, which is quite different from what the establishment viewpoint has been up until now, so you want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network. We'll be back after these messages.
Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out? Don't you know it's gonna be?
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
This week on Wiley and Sage, Love, Lust, and Laughter, Dr. Winston Wilde, author of Legacies of Love, A Heritage of Queer Bonding, and current president of the Western Region of the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. His book documents several thousand years of same-sex bonding on several continents, and Dr. Wilde also looks at the curious constellations of bisexuals and transgendered persons. That's this Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
You are listening to Progressive Radio Network.
Back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and let's turn it over to Jake, who's going to introduce our guest today. Jake?
Right, it's my very pleasure to introduce Jason Ditz. He is the news editor for Antiwar.com, and I haven't actually spoken with Jason before, but I've been reading his articles for the past several years since I first became aware of Antiwar.com, and I have to say I have a lot of admiration for his work. Jason, are you there with us?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah, much appreciated. And
again, I just to dive right into the questions, I had read one of the op-eds that you had, and one of the magazines I also get is Time. And for those that don't receive the Time magazine, they had a photograph of a woman on the front page of Time magazine that had her nose cut off. And they were using it more or less as the drive to get us to have a stay in Afghanistan. And I was wondering if you could comment on your thoughts on that. And
well, sure. There seems to be a twofold goal to this picture. I mean, this girl is obviously a very pretty young woman who had something horrible done to her. She had her nose cut off and apparently her ears, although you can't actually see that in the picture because she's wearing a head wrap. And it seems to focus the stories on both how dangerous it is to have peace talks with the Taliban and how dangerous it would be for the U.S. to hypothetically leave. And, of course, the message is this is what will happen if the U.S. has left Afghanistan. But in this case, it's what happened while the troops were in Afghanistan.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? It very rarely gets brought out that very often the scare tactics applied during the occupation or during the very thing that the government wants us to say we can't do without.
Right, and again, the picture is actually an extremely hideous one, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jason, but I believe it was her own husband that went before a local court and then administered the punishment, which was, as you said, cutting off the nose and also the ears.
Right. That's
so what
my
you're saying
too.
Is perhaps a better question is, you know, why is the United States allowing this to occur in the country we currently occupy?
Well, it's really sort of beside the point, except that they're trying to reshape the viewpoint of the war as something about women's rights, when obviously this is happening with 150,000 international troops in Afghanistan. So obviously, if this war is about women's rights, they're not doing a very good job of it.
Right, and to play devil's advocate for a moment, you know, there might be some that would say, well, you know, if the Taliban were in charge and, you know, they could administer their harsh Sharia law, they still have this continuing on. So what would you say to those that would say, well, you know, if the United States pulls out and they have the Taliban pull in, that this, you know, this type of action wouldn't just continue, but would actually grow?
Well, it's certainly possible that it would grow, but I think that the real reason things like this are happening is because Afghanistan's a pretty backwards country, and it's technologically backwards. People don't have a lot of services. And if you look historically, violence against women is worse during wars, and it's also pretty bad in primitive societies. And right now, after pretty much 30-plus years of war, Afghanistan has devolved into a pretty primitive country with not a lot going for it. And women's rights really isn't going to be an issue until they have a period of peace and prosperity that people will start worrying more about more than day-to-day survival.
Right, another question for you on the Afghanistan war, Jason, more out of curiosity than anything, because I've noticed that the death estimates out of Afghanistan for civilians, they're pretty hard to kind of come by. I had read a report by the Civic, a group called Civic, but I was wondering, are you aware of any estimates for how many civilians have died as a result since 2001?
Overall estimates, I'm not aware of any really good estimates. I mean, the United Nations will, from time to time, release an estimate for the past 6 months, which, in fact, they just released one this week. But these are pretty preliminary estimates, and they're mostly what makes it in the media and not much else. So I think, as far as the deaths going on in the countryside of Afghanistan, it's a lot, but it's probably a number that we'll never really have a full grasp on.
Gotcha. Walt, do you have a question?
Yeah, if Jason, if the Time magazine cover is designed to distract attention from WikiLeaks and from what's been coming out of that. Let's take a step back and look at those again, and maybe you can identify for us what specifically do you think they're most interested in trying to distract our attention away from WikiLeaks?
Well, I'm not so sure it's specifically related to the WikiLeaks release, but they're certainly trying to distract us from record death tolls, the fact that the war just keeps getting worse, the fact that the most recent new strategy, which was really just the old strategy with more troops, isn't accomplishing any more than the last new strategy was, and that there really isn't any sort of endgame strategy here.
So you see this as more of a the time photo would be more of a reaction to the war itself and its purpose or lack thereof, rather than anything more specific about WikiLeaks.
All right. I think the WikiLeaks thing is probably too recent for it to have been a major factor for Time magazine. I'm not sure they would have had much lead time to know it was coming to react like that quickly.
Yeah, it does make sense, doesn't it? Because typically magazines are planned months in ahead, so it would be rather surprising if they did have that kind of quick reaction time on a monthly, or even on a weekly, I guess it is, but very true. Do you have any input on how the situation in Iraq is affecting both the situation in Afghanistan and the current media reaction to Afghanistan?
Well, Iraq has certainly sort of taken a back seat to Afghanistan now as far as American media coverage, even though the death tolls in Iraq are rising pretty rapidly, too. I mean, last month we saw the highest civilian death tolls in Iraq in over 2 years, which was denied originally by the U.S., but not very credibly. I mean, they came up with their own civilian death numbers, which was fairly unusual for them to do in the first place. Usually they claim they don't keep track of civilian death numbers at all. And when they release these numbers, I mean, a media report from two separate incidents had already gotten you up over the American number for that month. So it was fairly obviously nowhere near the reality.
Now, as antiwar.com continues to play the role that it has always played, particularly in this scenario and with the WikiLeaks controversy and so forth, I know that you guys get hit with a lot of attacks from the military establishment, from media sources and so forth. What have you been seeing? Where have you been seeing most of the attacks coming from? Where do you think the greatest emphasis has been from their side?
Well, the attacks on the WikiLeaks release have really focused on two fronts, on WikiLeaks itself, of course, and trying to portray them as something other than a whistleblower's organization and perhaps something a little more insidious. And then Bradley Manning, the private who is apparently the source of all of these leaks, trying to portray him in as negative a light as possible. And it's really incredible how far they've gone in trying to dig up backstory on Manning and talking to people that knew him in elementary school and speculating that he might be a homosexual because of things that people who knew him in elementary school say about him, and commenting on how short he is and how what a loner he was. And it's really incredible the extent that they're going to try to come up with some sort of justification for why he released these documents other than the reason he gave in the heavily edited chat log of him commenting on releasing documents like this, which was that he was disillusioned with the war itself.
And, of course, after his name came to the forefront and got bandied about in the mainstream press, last week there was, of course, the new leak that came out from WikiLeaks. It was some sort of encrypted document, which I haven't heard anything more about. Do you guys have any more information? What's that document about? What does it contain?
There's nobody I know has any idea what it contains or what it might contain, except that it's, as a file, much, much larger than the previous release. I mean, enormously larger than the previous release. So whatever it is, there's a lot of it.
It struck me as really interesting, the timing of its release, because it did come out after the military basically announced they knew where the leaks were coming from, and then all of a sudden there's a new leak, which kind of gave the lie to it. Makes you wonder, well, how many other leaks are there that the military doesn't know about?
Right, and WikiLeaks, of course, hasn't released everything that they have. They have another 15,000 documents that they're planning on releasing at some point in the future, but they haven't really given a date for when those will be released.
I remember
they definitely have other things as well.
I remember seeing a segment that appeared on Fox News, Judge Napolitano's show, where he had a CIA spokesman, or actually a former CIA person, speaking for the government side, and of course, antiwar.com's presence was also visible on the show. During that particular episode, the CIA analyst basically accused WikiLeaks of treason and suggested that they should actually be brought to trial for that under the constitutional provisions for bringing treason charges against U.S. citizens. Now, of course, the founder of WikiLeaks is not a U.S. citizen, but it does raise some interesting questions. What would be your take on that? Do you think they have any grounds for that?
Well, it certainly doesn't seem so. I mean, the Supreme Court ruled in the Pentagon Papers case that media outlets have a perfect right to release classified documents if they're in the public interest, which I don't think there's any real argument that this wasn't in the public interest to know the contents of all of these files.
It was interesting because Judge Napolitano brought that up in the context of the discussion on that show and mentioned in particular the Pentagon Papers. The CIA analyst basically said he disagreed with the Pentagon Papers decision that was made by the courts at the time back during the Vietnam War. So it almost makes you wonder, does the CIA, do the military actually believe in honoring what the courts rule?
Well, I think whether or not they believe in it, they're going to have an awfully hard time overturning it or ignoring it in a case like that. I mean, Julian Assange, the WikiLeaks founder, is in London right now. I don't expect him to try to come to the United States anytime soon or to go to any country that's not in Western Europe, or his home country is Australia or countries like that. I think the U.S. would have an awfully hard time trying to circumvent their own law in going after him on foreign soil.
You may very well be right. Jake, I'm kind of dominating the questions here. If you want to jump in, go right ahead.
Oh, absolutely. I had a question. If anyone, either yourself or anyone at antiwar.com had a chance to go through the WikiLeaks releases, which was something like 78,000 documents, and try and find any smoking guns, so to speak.
Well, I went through some of them, but there's just so many. I don't think there's anybody that's gone through all of them. But as far as smoking guns, I mean, there wasn't really one report that stood out to me. There were a lot of little reports that stood out to me that there's a pattern of behavior that the Pentagon clearly realized over the course of this six-year period how badly this war was going, and at the same time insists that they were telling the House Intelligence and Senate Foreign Affairs Committee how bad this war was going. But when they testify in open testimony to the broader Congress or give comments to the American public, it's a completely different story, and it's that the war is just about to turn around.
Yeah, well, how about evidence suggesting, because this really came out in the original, I think, AP release, evidence suggesting that United States foreign aid money that has been flowing to Pakistan in order to supposedly combat terrorism is being funneled by the Pakistani civil spy service back into these insurgents and Taliban forces.
Well, that's something that we've heard rumors to that effect for a long time, and there were a lot of reports to that effect in these leaked documents, but they were, again, not necessarily backed up by a whole bunch of evidence. They were mostly citing Afghan spy agency people saying this is what is happening. The Pakistan's Inter-Service Intelligence Agency is funding this group or that group or directing this group or that group. But I think as far as knowing how much of that is true and how much of that is just speculation, it's awfully hard to say.
It reminds me a little bit of an article that had come out, I think, earlier this year in The Nation magazine, where they had United States soldiers quoted as, you know, and this is inside Pakistan itself, literally bribing the Taliban so they wouldn't attack supply escorts and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, the bribery of warlords and even Taliban-linked insurgents is pretty common both in Pakistan and in southern Afghanistan. I mean, that supply route from the Karachi through the Khyber Pass and Peshawar and into Afghanistan is basically the only reliable route that doesn't take an enormous amount of time to get supplies into the country, and it's not a very safe route. There are an awful lot of choke points that are just ripe for ambush, so there's a lot of bribery going on all the time trying to make that route at least semi-feasible.
Jason, in a recent article you wrote at HeraldNews.com, you described the war in Afghanistan as being something of a mystery religion. Could you elaborate on that?
Well, yeah, that sort of goes back to the point of the Pentagon and the House Intelligence Committee and the Foreign Affairs Committee and the Senate being told all of these things that were in the WikiLeaks documents, while at the same time, even the broader Congress and in general and the American public, too, of course, are being kept in the dark about a lot of what's going on in the war. And it's really gotten to the point now where it's not even that they're keeping secrets from the American public about the war, it's that they're overtly lying about a lot of what's going on in the war just for our benefit so that we aren't too opposed to the conflict.
And what's your take on how those lies are being received by the American public? Are they still eating them up? Are they questioning them? What do you see from where you sit?
Well, there was a new poll today from NBC News and the Wall Street Journal that showed that 68% of the American public says they're getting less and less confident about the war. And for the first time ever, a slight majority disapprove of the way President Obama is handling the war. So I think it's slow going, and a lot of people are really reluctant to change their mind after this being the good war for so many years. But slowly but surely, a lot of people's eyes are opening, and they're starting to see that this war really isn't going well and probably shouldn't be continued. Although, again, it's very slow going.
That's certainly an interesting theme, isn't it, given how much emphasis the president placed on both his proposed policy in Afghanistan and in Iraq when he was running for election. So the fact that the American public had become disenchanted with the very position he campaigned on is a significant turn, isn't it?
It is. And ironically, President Bush seems to have had the right idea on Afghanistan, not so much in the original invasion, but once he got there, he kept the presence sort of small, and small enough that the American public didn't really notice how bad the war was going. And it seems like as President Obama has escalated it more and more, it's just blowing up in his face, and it's becoming more and more obvious what a disaster this was. And politically, I think it's going to be damaging to him in the long term.
Right, and well, the summers are also the bloodiest in terms of like the weather and the mobility of the insurgents and Taliban forces. I had a question for you. Are you aware of the Pat Tillman story?
I'm aware of it, but I'm not hugely up on it.
Okay. Well, just for our listeners out there, there is a movie coming out, The Tillman Story, that has been put together by the Tillman family. And for those that may be unaware, Pat Tillman was an NFL star who left, you know, playing for multi-million-dollar contracts to go serve his country over in Afghanistan. And during that time period, there was a friendly fire incident where He was for sure killed, and there was a cover-up by the military, and appears to be an overt attempt to turn him into some type of war hero, where the facts may be that completely different. So it'll be interesting to see the Americans. The website is the Tillmanstory.com, and it looks like it'll be hitting the theaters on August the 20th, so it'll be interesting to see if that has an impact and also how many theaters it's able to make it out to.
And we should also clarify that it wasn't so much that that Pat Tillman was falsely made out to be a war hero, because apparently he served with distinction, but rather that the circumstances of his death were not the heroic act that was originally reported by the military, but rather he was likely felled by friendly fire.
Absolutely.
Right, that does sound interesting. When did you say it was coming out?
August the 20th. And
August
again,
the 20th?
It's Tillmanstory.com, and they have a trailer up. And they've had some exposure on CNN and that sort of thing recently. And it'll be interesting to see, because again, you're getting the family's perspective, which they claim that they still don't know what happened to their son, and that's all they're kind of worried about. So their claims is that there is a cover-up. I'm sure that and it goes up as high as General Stanley McChrystal, who was recently I forget if he was technically fired or if he technically resigned, but he ended up being in charge of the troops over in Afghanistan and then leaving the war. He was actually involved as a commanding officer in this incident back then. And again, there could be different perspectives on exactly what does happen. And you know, the reality is war is a complete mess, and you have to be very careful before you start to involve yourself in things like that. But another question for you, Jason, I guess, you know, what do you think would actually happen if the United States were to pull out, or if they were to pursue diplomatic talks with the Taliban?
Well, I think either ways, a similar thing is going to happen, which is that the Taliban is going to get a fairly influential role in the government. I don't think the Afghan government as it is composed right now would necessarily just collapse. I think it doesn't necessarily have a lot of support, but it does have a lot of money and enough influential people behind it that they could probably, even without the U.S. military presence, negotiate some sort of settlement where they're still in the picture in some shape or form.
Of course, Afghanistan's President Hamid Karzai would probably disagree with you. He's been calling for a much greater intervention by both U.S. and international troops. He seems to think that it's going to be critical toward maintaining the stability of his government.
Well, I think if he wants to keep his government as it is composed right now, which is with him having virtually unlimited powers as the executive of the government, he's probably right there. But I think his government probably wouldn't completely collapse. It would just sort of be blended into a new government with the Taliban involved.
So you don't really think that the Taliban will regain their level of total dominance that they had before the war?
Not really, no. I don't think...
Why is that?
Well, I think it's been so long now, and they were fighting this... civil war with the Northern Alliance for years before the U.S. invaded, and after billions and billions of dollars thrown at Northern Alliance affiliated people, I think now would be a perfect time for them to come to some sort of final settlement of that old conflict instead of just starting up the civil war again.
But of course, the Taliban did have a very strong presence in the South. I mean, that's where they really were rock solid with their strength. Is there any reason to believe that would not continue once the American and international presence was withdrawn?
Oh, no, it would definitely continue. I think as far as the national government is concerned, there would probably be some sort of power sharing, but I think you would see more and more local power centers with Taliban forces setting up their own local governments in places where there really isn't a real presence by the NATO-backed government.
And certainly that would have to include Kabul, wouldn't it?
Probably. It probably would include Kabul. It would definitely include Kandahar.
Mm-hmm.
But Kabul has a lot of different warlords and people that are former warlords that are part of the government now, who I think would still be in the picture in some shape or form without the U.S. It's so hard to speculate on what actually would happen in the future, but I think they would still be there.
And, of course, one of the main non-reasons given, reasons that were never really specific for being in Afghanistan in the first place, was to reduce and perhaps even wipe out that Taliban presence. But what hope do the people who are speaking for the establishment, for the military, what hope do they have in actually achieving that if we do stay in Afghanistan?
I think there's no real chance that you're going to wipe out the Taliban militarily. It seems like the more troops the U.S. sends, the more Taliban they kill. It also translates into the more civilians they kill that they say were linked to the Taliban, and the more civilians that they kill just by accident, and it boosts the insurgency. So I think in the long run, that group isn't going anywhere.
Of course, Taliban is a word that basically means student, and it raises the question, as Taliban are killed off, do more students come forward and become new Taliban? That does seem to be part of the pattern, doesn't it?
Right. If you go by the number of times that the U.S. has claimed to kill dozens or hundreds of Taliban fighters over the years, I mean, they've killed an enormous number of people. I don't have the exact figures, but it's certainly in the tens of thousands of people that they've killed, and it doesn't seem like that group is getting any smaller. So I think they're definitely able to replace their followers at least as fast as the U.S. is able to kill them, even at this latest escalation where it's up to 150,000 troops.
And Jake, I'm not sure if you have more questions left, but I have one more question that I want to ask you before we end this particular segment. One thing that always bothered me about the Afghanistan action was it was originally designed to go after Osama bin Laden, who was alleged to have been the mastermind of the 9/11 plot, and that was really the main driving force in putting us into Afghanistan in the first place. That particular reason seems to have disappeared from the radar screen entirely, which bothers me, and I'm sure it bothers many Americans. But the one thing that bothers me even more than that is from the get-go, the entire situation was treated as if it needed to be a military action. The whole idea of a war on terror, as if you could declare war on an emotion, and the treatment of terrorists as if they were enemy combatants. I mean, that, to my mind, that raises criminals to a level of respect that they really don't deserve. From my point of view, I always thought that we should be treating it as a police-type thing. We should actually be going in and treating them like criminals to be tracked down and brought to trial. And, of course, that never really happened. And so I guess my question is, have you ever thought of it in those terms? And if we had tried to treat it as a criminal action and tried to engage the various governments in the area in helping to collect criminals, do you think there would have been any different result to what's happened over in that region?
Well, there would certainly be a different result if, for no other reason than that the U.S. wouldn't have had and continue to have 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, and large numbers of U.S. troops wouldn't have been killed over there. But, I think a lot of these governments were willing to, over the years, extradite Osama bin Laden and other people to the United States, and they were never taken up on those offers.
And that's true, and that's why I keep wondering about it. It's just one of these subjects that gnaws at me. If we had handled this differently, if we'd stopped trying to elevate terror as if it were something you could declare a war on, and stopped elevating enemy terrorists to the level of a combatant, which is often considered in war terminology to be a level of respect. You're certainly fighting and trying to kill the enemy, but there's also a certain degree of military respect that goes on there. It just strikes me as being really contradictory to what the supposed goals of the war were.
Right. It was something that could be sold as a major action, even if it wasn't a particularly wise action. And I think a lot of people wanted a major a major reaction to 9/11, but they at the time didn't really consider the wisdom of what that action would be.
Yeah, that's so true. Absolutely. Well, we've really enjoyed having you on the program here. We've been chatting off the program here between ourselves in an online chat, trying to figure out how long we wanted to keep you here. But I think we've kind of run the course of the discussion. Can you just give the audience a little bit of detail about where they can learn more about anti-war? Well, obviously antiwar.com, but how they can get involved in your efforts if they're interested.
Well, yeah, I mean, definitely go to antiwar.com. Most of my writings appear at news.antiwar.com, which is where all the news summaries and things like that appear. But, yeah, just check out the website, and all the information should be there.
Well, all right. Well, thank you very much for joining us on the program today. You've been very informative and not surprising considering the great work that antiwar.com does. And those listeners who are not familiar with it, we urge you to go there because there's a lot of very good information. Antiwar.com has really a terrific news gathering and distribution network going on there. And so I want to commend you for what you guys have been doing.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jason. Keep up the great work.
And we're going to take a short break, and then we'll be back for the last 5-10 minutes or so of the program. So stay tuned. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown on the Progressive Radio Network.
No, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. But when you talk about destruction, don't you know that you can count me out?
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
Acclaimed theoretical physicist Dr. Michio Kaku hosts Explorations, with topics ranging from the physics of gravity to the ever-expanding universe. With his lighthearted personality and natural charisma, Dr. Kaku breaks down intricate theories with a comprehensible approach. He's one of the greatest popularizers of science, who will take you on a fascinating journey into the world of scientific understanding. So let's take an exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku every Tuesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Loyal PRN listeners, do you have any broadcast industry experience? You listen to the Progressive Radio Network, you call into the Progressive Radio Network, and now you can even host your own show on the Progressive Radio Network. PRN is looking for talented, vibrant hosts for a plethora of new shows on various topics such as college life, Caribbean music, cooking, technology, senior citizen lifestyles, classical music, different cultures of the world, and conspiracy theories. If you have experience hosting programming in radio or television, and you have a progressive point of view, we have the perfect forum for you to have your voice be heard and air your progressive thoughts. Call 646-307-4482 or send us an email at karalee@garynoel.com. karalee@garynoel.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Krishnamurti's dialogue is between him and us.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti's talks are about the art of living, which is greater than all things that human beings have created by mind or hand.
Krishna.
It's greater than all the scriptures and their gods.
Krishna.
It is only through the art of living that a new culture can come into being.
Krishna.
All existence is relationship. Without it, you cannot live.
Krishna.
There is only the actual and nothing else.
Krishna.
What is taking place now is free of time.
Krishna.
This is the evolution of our conditioning.
Krishna.
The art of living can come into being only when thought does not contaminate love.
Krishna.
Krishnamurti talks, Thursday nights at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. Become enlightened.
Krishna.
This is PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know.
We're back here on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we'll get back to the headlines in just a moment. Just want to remind you that you can check on upcoming broadcasts of the Freedom News Hour by visiting our website at www.freedomnewshour.com. We try to get the information about upcoming guests on there as soon as the information becomes available to us. Obviously, when you're getting guests, you never really know exactly when you're going to get the next guest for the next show, but we do try to inform you as soon as we possibly can, so do check the website. You'll also find there that there is a link to archives of past shows, and we have had some very good shows in the past, including one that I know, Jake, is probably firmly in your mind. It's been in my mind since we did it. That was the July 1st show where we had G. Edward Griffin coming on to talk about the financial crisis, the nature of the banking system, and so forth. A very informative show.
Well, absolutely. I think that having guests like Jason Ditz of antiwar.com is just fabulous. And I was just checking out their website. It looks like they have a pledge drive going on as well. Having Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature of Jekyll Island, was it was a great show as well. So those are all available on the archives.
And, of course, Jason was here talking about Afghanistan and Iraq and the U.S. presence in those countries. So it's a sort of a natural segue to talk about the latest country where U.S. troops are starting to appear. And Jake has all the details about that. Jake?
Sure. And this is a bit of an older story. It actually happened back in July. But the United States has sent 7,000 troops, an Air Force carrier, about 200 helicopters, and 40 flotilla, really, of 46 warships into Costa Rican waters. And they are there publicly. The reasons for this is to stop the narcotics trade, since Costa Rica is used as a transit point from Panama and Colombia into the United States. But you can debate about whether or not sending in the military into regions like this is valuable. But what I like to just point out is you can go search for this on CNN or any of the big media networks, and it's just crickets. There's nothing there. And having our troops involved, especially sending 100,000 troops to Afghanistan, sending a tenth of them into Costa Rica in Latin America, very close to our borders, is something I think that should have made some type of a news splash, and yet has not done so at all.
And I can't help but wondering, the moment that you mentioned Costa Rica, it just brought to my mind a phenomenon that most Americans probably are not aware of, but there is a very strong libertarian presence in Costa Rica. There is an organization, a political party known as the Movimiento Libertario. And Movimiento Libertario has actually become a rather strong minority party within the Costa Rican government. And as a matter of fact, I believe they're the number three party in the government right now. They have something like 10 to 15% of the seats in parliament, and it just makes me wonder: does this new U.S. presence have something to do with the libertarian movement in Costa Rica?
Well, there's certainly inside Costa Rica. There's been quite a bit of debate about it since they're a country without a standing army. but again, that's one of the key things is. America just keeps intervening in the affairs of all these countries, and it's not just Costa Rica, it's not just Afghanistan, it's not just Iraq. We have troops in over 150 of the world's 200 countries, and that's something we really need to take a close look at, because obviously my view is, the people that live there are going to be able to govern themselves a lot better than outsiders.
Yes, absolutely true. It's also laughable in light of the fact that the financial crisis continues to deepen. We continue to go deeply into debt. We're now well over $13 trillion in debt as a nation, and that's just the national debt, not counting individual consumer business debt. The debt just keeps growing and growing. And any time that you have that number of troops, that amount of presence around the world, it obviously has to keep continuing to contribute to the debt, because there's no way that they're able to pay for all that so-called defense
presence in addition to all of the social programs, the new health care program, and so on and so forth. I mean, the obvious truth is that because we keep going deeper and deeper in debt, it's more and more clear every day. We just don't have the taxpayer funds to cover all these expenditures. So at what point do we say enough is enough?
Right, and it's extremely expensive. And one of the things I like to point out is, you know, when there was a American captain taken captive over in Somalia several months ago, and there was a destroyer, one ship, not 46 ships like was sent to Costa Rica, but one ship was sent there. And later on, there was remarks that, you know, it might have been actually cheaper to get, and obviously we need to act to get our citizens back and protect our citizens. But the amount of sending that warship in there was several millions of dollars. And so what we're talking about here, 46 warships, 7,000 troops, you're in the tens and maybe probably tens of millions of dollars being spent. And again, it's just not in the public discourse. It's not covered by the mainstream press. And I think that's a real shame.
It's a real shame, and it's also quite scary that the mainstream press doesn't consider that kind of thing to be newsworthy, because it may not be major news now, but at the rate things are going, it's going to become major news. There's no way it can be avoided that I can see. We're nearing the end of the program here, less than 2 minutes left. I just wanted to have you touch, actually down to 1 minute left, I want you to touch very briefly on a scare story that's going around about war babies. Tell us about that one, Jake.
Well, what the mainstream press is covering on CNN last night, Anderson Cooper was talking about these terror babies, which apparently was brought up by some members of Congress on the floor of Congress, that somehow there's this plot of immigrants or illegal immigrants coming over here of Middle Eastern descent, having a baby, and then taking them away to incubate them for 20 years and send them back as terrorists. I just find that to be extremely ludicrous that our nation's leaders would be, you know, looking into things like this. And the CNN investigation showed that there really wasn't anything behind the allegations, but the fact that they would bring this up on the House floor when our whole country is going through the worst economy really in the past 80 years since the Great Depression is highly disturbing.
And, of course, it's an obvious play toward those who are very concerned about immigration issues. They're just trying to stir up sympathy over on that side.
Exactly. Divide and conquer type tactics, and that's what the political establishment in this country has been doing for quite some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we got less than 30 seconds left, but I guess we've run out of time at just the right moment, because we've pretty much used up all of the material we have for today's show. But, Jake, as usual, it's been a pleasure, and I look forward to seeing you in next week's show.
Oh, yeah. Come on back next week.
And, of course, Melinda will be back joining us at that time. So join us again next week on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, and we'll have a special guest listed on the website, so be sure to check that. Goodbye, everybody.
Take care, everyone.
We all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution.